Lisa Newman, Peter Feltham from the CPSU and Joe Justo from the ASU. And I think the arrangement is that the CPSU will present first. Thank you very much. Would you like to make your presentation?
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, President. The CPSU has recommended that the APS Act values be expanded to include all forms of discrimination, including sexual preference, as a part, as per paragraph 11 of our submission, which Peter will hand up to you. We contend this expanded wording
Thank you very much.
Further identify and promote the understanding of what constitutes discrimination. This is particularly important as the APS Code of Conduct and values are promoted widely through the public sector and a point of consistent reference within many APS agreements. Currently, there's no public service-wide scrutiny of the implementation and adherence to APS values, and this responsibility falls to individual agencies. As a consequence, education strategies relating to the APS Code of Conduct and values vary and may, as a result, give rise to potential discrimination. We believe an explicit statement in the APS values, as suggested in our recommendation, will improve education across the public service. And as we all know, education is a critical part of prevention of discrimination strategies. Consistent with this recommendation, we've also recommended that the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations policy parameters for public sector agreement making be amended to expand on the current reference to discrimination on the basis of sexual preference. And I would refer you to paragraph 16 again of our submission. We believe our recommendation, if it were adopted, would strengthen the explicit prohibition on discrimination regardless of the employment instrument. The majority of CPSU members are covered by collective certified agreements. These agreements are highly transparent public documents, and we're very concerned that the current government policy seeks to encourage public sector employees to reduce collective agreements content in favour of principle-based agreements, which heavily refer to employer policy. And we would refer you to page 24 of the policy parameters under the heading of Simple and Flexible Workplace Agreements, which we will hand up to you. Employer policy is generally outside the public domain and therefore is less transparent and more difficult to monitor. It can also be changed unilaterally by employers. The increased use of individual employment contracts, including AWAs, which are not subject to public scrutiny, places the burden of identification of discriminatory provisions and the cost and risk associated with seeking remedies for any resulting disadvantage on individual workers. We believe this burden to be unfair and unreasonable. The lack of scrutiny of individual employment contracts and the reduced level of scrutiny of collective agreements will produce an increased risk of the expansion or introduction of discriminatory arrangements. We believe that if JURA to continue to effectively monitor agreements for compliance to the policy parameters, we believe an expanded policy parameter on discrimination will assist JURA with that important task. In relation to our members in the private sector, these group of workers are particularly vulnerable. Their employment is often regulated by awards only. Those employed casually are often paid a flat rate in lieu of leave and other entitlements. The unregulated nature of their employment means these workers are at significant risk of workplace discrimination. We've also made submissions to the Award Review Task Force, which is charged with making recommendations to the government in relation to further simplification and rationalisation of federal awards. Our submission to the task force details our concerns at the potential losses of entitlements and awards in favour of less transparent arrangements controlled solely by employers. And again, we see an increased risk of potential discrimination if this were to occur. We strongly believe that if the government is to give practical expression to its commitment to anti-discrimination, HERIOC is going to require additional resources to support and monitor compliance within the federal discrimination laws. and I refer you to paragraph 20 of our submission. In relation to specific areas of discrimination, we see the exclusion of same-sex partners via the use of the spouse definition and eligibility criteria as a primary offending provision in agreements, awards and legislation. This definition is commonly used in relation to remote localities, carer's leave, adoption leave, parental leave, maternity leave, bereavement leave, relocation entitlements and allowances, and superannuation. The increased pressure on public sector employers to transfer award and agreement entitlements to employer policy could make these entitlements and allowances less transparent and in some cases unenforceable. It's for this reason our recommendation seeks to provide a much more rigorous framework for monitoring workplace arrangements to ensure that workers are protected from discrimination regardless of their employment instrument. In relation to the Commonwealth Public Sector CSS and the Public Sector Superannuation Scheme PSS, we can confirm that both these super schemes discriminate in regard to death benefits for same-sex partners. Again, the eligibility for the entitlement being based on the definition of spouse contained within the Superannuation Act 1976 and the Superannuation Act 1990 does not recognise same-sex partners. And we'd like to hand you up a table that details specifically what this particular Act actually affects in relation to the death benefits. And I'd invite Peter Feltham to take you through the table, if I may.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Just very briefly, this table is divided into three columns. The first column is the eligibility for the contributor to the CSS or PSS and or a PSS or CSS pensioner. The second column identifies, in the case of the death of the contributor or pensioner, what their married or de facto partner would be eligible for. The third column identifies what a same-sex partner would be eligible for. If I could just point out, I suppose, the two most significant examples there at the bottom, the third and fourth examples. The third example, it states that a CSS or PSS pensioner and partner receive an index pension of $30,000 per annum. That's based on their accumulated superannuation benefits. In the case of a married or de facto partner, on the death of that pensioner, the partner would be entitled to an index reversionary pension of 67% of the pension that was previously paid to that pensioner. That is, they would receive $20,100 of that original $30,000 pension that the pensioner received. In the case of a same-sex partner, there is no entitlement for a reversionary pension at all, so there'd be no benefit payable to a same-sex partner in that situation. The fourth example is the case of a PSS or CSS pensioner partner and a dependent child. They would again receive that index pension of $30,000 per annum. On the death of that CSS or PSS pensioner, the partner and dependent child, in the case of a married or de facto relationship, would receive a reversionary pension of 78% of their pension previously paid, which would equal $23,400 per annum. In the case of a same-sex partner, only the dependent child would receive any benefit at all, and the dependent child would be treated as an orphan and receive an index pension of 45% of that pension previously paid. So out of the $30,000 originally paid to the pensioner, the orphan would receive $13,500 per annum. The same-sex partner would not be entitled to any benefit at all.
As Peter's outlined, the discrimination results in significant financial disadvantage on the death of a same-sex partner in relation to the level of entitlement to pensions and or lump sum payments. In some instances, there's no direct entitlement at all for either the same-sex partner or any children from that relationship. Currently, the Superannuation Act 1993 and its regulations have a broader definition for determining eligibility to entitlements than either the PSS or CSS schemes. The SysAct regulations identify those who are in relationships of interdependency and does not exclude or disadvantage same-sex partners from death benefits. We've made a number of representations to the Department of Finance and Administration and other government inquiries stating that the current discrimination against same-sex partners could and should be removed. We have recommended that this could be achieved by amending the Superannuation Act 1976 and the Superannuation Act 1990 to adopt the CIS Act definition of interdependency. And this is, again, the recommendation we make to this inquiry, and I refer you to paragraph 44 of our submission. Our submission also identifies that the Tax Office does not recognise same-sex partners for the range of allowances, including remote localities allowance. One of our recommendations is that this to this inquiry is that this matter be addressed directly with the Tax Office, and I refer you to paragraph 48 of our submission. In conclusion, the CPSU does not believe that there is any valid evidence of community support for discrimination on the basis of sexual preference. Our union values the contribution of all our members, regardless of their sexual preference, and we believe our union is stronger for its diversity. We believe these principles to be true for the Australian Public Service and the community at large. We believe it's unjust for same-sex partners to be denied access to entitlements such as carers leave, relocation allowances, and superannuation benefits enjoyed by those in heterosexual relationships. Our union believes that the current definition of spouse we use to define eligibility for entitlements, be they within awards, agreements, or legislation, either implicitly or explicitly discriminate against same-sex partners. Those in same-sex partnerships make valuable and valid contributions to their workplaces, their organisations, the public sector and their community. And we think it's about time they were shown the respect and justice they deserve. These forms of discrimination are unacceptable, and we believe out of step with a modern secular society that values a fair go for all. Thank you.
Lisa, thank you very much. ASU, perhaps make its submissions and then we may have one or two questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Commissioner, on behalf of the Australian Services Union, I extend our thanks and congratulations to the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission for this inquiry into discrimination against people in same-sex relationships on their financial and work-related benefits. We also appreciate, on behalf of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex and queer members of the Australian Services Union, the time afforded to us today to place verbal submissions in support of our written submission to you. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the incredible strength and commitment of the LGBTIQ members and officials of the ASU, who are otherwise known as GLAM, who work very hard to educate all members and the community to the rights and privileges that should be afforded to LGBTIQ workers and to end all forms of discrimination. It's my intention to focus on three areas for the Commission's reference. These are to provide further examples of the denial of employment benefits to same-sex couples beyond our written submission, to identify the difficulties faced by people wishing to negotiate rights and benefits for their same-sex partner and families in Australian Workplace Agreements, or AWAs, and to provide examples of some of the rights that have been gained by the Australian Services Union and how they've been achieved. And finally, we will present recommendations to this inquiry for further action. The Australian Services Union also acknowledges that there are many other areas of employment benefits and rights to those I've just mentioned where equality for same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples does not exist, such as taxation, Medicare and superannuation. And to that end, we support all of the union submissions received by this inquiry in writing and those of today. However, I've outlined our focus for the purposes of this inquiry. Our written submission, along with our presentation today, is based on an industrial understanding of our bargaining and campaigning abilities rather than an analysis of a multitude of individual issues. We believe that whilst there does not exist within the federal system a strong and openly spoken set of legislative protections, employees will be reluctant in any numbers to come forward on issues of workplace discrimination on the basis of their sexual preference or partner status, and therefore significant stories and data are limited. Until such time as all employees are educated to the fact that regardless of legislative provisions, such rights belong to all employees and not just those in opposite-sex couples. With that education and strength in bargaining, only then will we see a substantial change. There are a certain number of individual matters around the country as a union that we have participated in resolving on behalf of our members, and usually these result in financial settlement and the employee ultimately seeking work elsewhere. And whilst there is a vacuum of legislative rights and a cone of silence until now on these issues, major breakthroughs on mass change and employment benefits has been reliant directly on the workers' bargaining strengths. The areas of employment benefits that I'll focus on are carer's leave, parental leave, which includes maternity, paternity and adoption, bereavement leave, access to annual leave and unpaid leave. While speaking specifically about what I would prefer to call employment rights rather than benefits in the federal jurisdiction, it must be acknowledged that employment rights in state jurisdictions are better supported in legislative terms and therefore positive results are a little more common. One outstanding issue across all spectres of this debate is the use of gender-based language. The history of terms such as he and she in the award system have historically not been challenged in a range of arenas or instruments, and this has led to a cut-and-paste phenomena in industrial instruments, which has led to further discriminatory practices by default rather than purposefully. The denial of rights or benefits to same-sex couples in the federal system is underpinned in the Workplace Relations Act at Section C, subparagraph M, the principal object, which states, respecting and valuing the diversity of the workforce by helping to prevent and eliminate discrimination on the basis of race, colour, sex, sexual preference, age, physical or mental disability, marital status, family responsibility, pregnancy, religion, political opinion, national extraction and or social origin. And at N, it states that assisting in giving effect to Australia's international obligations in relation to labour standards. Unfortunately, these principal objects are not reflected anywhere else in the body of the Act. Whilst carer's leave now undertakes the ability for an employee to take carer's leave as for a member of a household, there are no other positive benefits. Employees' access to all of these forms of leave is predicated on the employee being required to give some form of information to the employer in order to have the leave approved, or there is a requirement for the provision of medical certificates to support the carer's or bereavement leave. This raises a sundry issue for employees if they have not been able to find a supportive medical practitioner or, due to costs, are reliant on the public health system and their local service, possibly for religious reasons, will not provide the appropriate paperwork, introduces a whole new level of discrimination. So as an example, a woman employee who has not disclosed her relationship status in the workplace requires carer's leave, and as it can be imagined for any other individual, there's no requirement for discomfort or concern on disclosure. For a person who is not out in the workplace for an enormous range of reasons, backed in most cases by likely fear, this poses a significant problem. It's also particularly a problem if there are no provisions within an agreement or other industrial instrument that will give guidance to the employer that this is something that they must do, not one that they can make a judgment on. Employees wishing to take annual leave or join the Christmas roster or indeed deal with school holidays in an environment where, due to numbers of employees, rosters or allotment of holiday ballots that have to take place, they're often reluctant to step forward and identify that they have parental obligations and need to participate in the school holiday scheduling. If there was a legislative benchmark or right given and that was reinforced with the strength of a collectively bargained agreement, then an employee should feel no fear in coming forward and be able to engage in balancing their work and family life. The provisions of parental leave allows for a range of conditions for employees, and where a strong union collective agreement has not been delivered, members of same-sex couples who are denied any form of access to leave except for maternity leave. And as previously mentioned, this was one area where, without an analysis of the benefits to be provided, the simple use of gender-based language again only adds to the difficulty in gaining access to what should be the primary caregiver or the secondary caregiver. At this point in time, generally, there are no provisions for women to access paternity leave or men to access any part of paid maternity leave. I will provide examples later of agreements which provide a variety of levels of support to same-sex couples in parental leave clauses. Bereavement leave also delivers the same challenges for disclosure in the workplace without any form of instrumental protection. Attempting to gain bereavement leave for the loss of your partner's parent becomes extremely difficult, if not impossible, for you if you have not disclosed your status in the workplace. If your status is not embraced and accepted in the workplace, then you are less likely to ask for such a right in a regime of the quick dismissal. The difficulties faced by people attempting to negotiate any of these and other rights in their workplace are contingent on a range of matters. That is, that the industrial instrument which underpins their employment, any policies or procedures in the workplace, and the culture and the environment in which they exist. As we have represented the industrial instrument effectively now in the federal system is the Workplace Relations Act. We have identified its lack of ability to afford protection to employees who identify as being in same-sex relationships or as a couple. We also have identified what continuing difficulties there are in place for employees who identify as same-sex couples who wish to participate in union collective agreements, and that for the education and the foundation for building strength, which needs to be in place to gain good outcomes, is not reflective in what happens for individual employees faced with the prospect of negotiating an Australian Workplace Agreement or an AWA or any type of individual contract with their employer. Clearly, negotiations of any type are concluded successfully on the basis of there being a reasonably fair balance of power. This can be gained in a number of ways collectively, but for the lone employee, this is almost impossible, dangerous, and a preposterous task. As per our previous examples, there are a range of matters that you would want to have included in your AWA. I should state at this point that the Australian Services Union does not support in any way the notion of individual negotiations as the pathway to achieve the best result for the individual, the business, the industry or the economy. Collective bargaining is engaging in the assurity that people's rights are addressed and fought for. So as the individual facing their employer under the new regime of industrial laws, they effectively have one alternative: accept the AWA as the employer presents it to you or look for a job elsewhere. Unless you come from mighty strong stock and have skills that no employer can do without, you are faced with accepting conditions which have to only lawfully meet the Australian Fair Pay standards, a minimum of 5 conditions, which in no way reflects the objects of the Workplace Relations Act, which in no way reflects any of the international labour obligations we are obliged to follow, and the individual is forced to take it or leave it. For a number of members of the LGBTI community, this can be multiplied in its detrimental effect by facing reversion to the social security system if they are unable to accept an AWA, which, for example, limits their access to sick leave substantially. They may have HIV/AIDS, a related illness. They may need to care for a partner with a significant illness, and without the ability to negotiate those conditions into their agreement, they would be forced to look for work elsewhere. The introduction of the Welfare to Work Bill will further discriminate against them, as they cannot force an agreement to contain provisions to deal with their status as a same-sex couple. They are then forced to be dependent on the welfare system, which will ultimately punish them with a minimum penalty of waiting for benefits for 8 weeks as a result of rejecting an unfair AWA. Clearly, there is no favour in the individual system for negotiating working conditions and benefits, and even if an individual was in such an amazing position that they could, the employer is not forced to comply, as there is no legislative bottom line or safety net. Most people are law-abiding. If the law doesn't tell them, they are open to influences which may not offer the best interpretation on rights for same-sex couples. I have with me for the Commission's interest some industrial agreements, both post-work choices, both in the private sector and those of companies who have relatively large profits and mediocre employee relationships. These agreements have been collectively bargained. As a result of the employee education in the matter of maternity, paternity, adoption and carers leave, these agreements reflect outcomes for same-sex couples in some of the employment provisions. The ASU has several other national agreements, but chosen these for today's purpose. In the instance of the Canon Agreement, whilst the definition and the intention of the definitions are not seen as specific to the company's policy is supportive and the parental leave is far from ideal. However, the company offered in positive steps to remove the gender-specific language. There is an agreement for Regional Express Airlines where there exist the same issues on the merits or otherwise of the parental leave clauses, and there is certainly room for improvement. However, the use of gender-specific language has been removed, and the claim is to ensure access regardless of couple status or definition. These two examples show that even though variations of entitlements for same-sex couples can be included in agreements, there is much opportunity for employers to use such provisions as leverage in negotiations, and as such, inferior clauses can be the result. In a different environment where the employer has a clear understanding of human rights and obligations and where employees have strength and solidarity, the potential to deliver excellent results is possible. I will also provide for the Commission's interest a copy of the Amnesty International Agreement, which is a pre-work choices agreement and is a result of strong negotiations. It contains a terrific parental leave clause, which was one of the many good results in that agreement. The same considerations could be applied to all types of gender or couple status identifying clauses in agreements if the right environment is met. Employees are endlessly denied access to these rights in individual instruments as in difference to heterosexual couples. When there is no requirement or obligation on any of the parties to protect the rights of all, ultimately, unfortunately, the majority will not. Therefore, the ability for this Commission to influence changes would include, and the ASU strongly supports, that HERIOC ensure that all provisions of the Workplace Relations Act reflect the stated objectives, that the federal government be pursued vigorously to make legislative changes removing all forms of discrimination against same-sex couples, and further that the Commission work to assist the parties during the next phase of negotiations on the definitions relevant to the Family Provisions Test Case. In summary, employees are denied access to a range of employment benefits afforded to heterosexual couples, including carers leave and bereavement leave, and through definitions of family and partner, etc. Maternity, paternity, adoption, or partner-spouse definitions and gender-specific language in all levels of industrial instruments denies rights to individuals, partners, and families. Access to rosters for holidays, while not necessarily legislative-based, also reflects another avenue for heterosexual superiority. Employers are not forced to ensure that all types of families are considered, and they should be. AWAs are a scourge in the employment landscape for any employee, regardless of sexual preference. Clearly, the ability for employees to accept inferior conditions or show them the door, in effect, displays the little hope employees in a same-sex relationship will have in negotiating these rights. We applaud the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission's inquiry, and we look forward to assisting the Commission further and encourage the Commission to take up on the recommendations made by the ASU. Thank you.
Thank you, Jo, very much. Can I just come back to the CPSU? You advocated the interdependency test. There have been some criticisms offered about that in some of the submissions we've received. Thank you, Jo. On the basis that it in itself is to some extent discriminatory, it's putting people through tests which de facto couples normally wouldn't, heterosexual de facto couples wouldn't be facing. I just wonder whether you had any concerns about that test, even though you're putting it forward as a possible solution.
I think the criteria under the CIS Act regulations cover a range of standards of which trustees of superannuation boards have to take into account. Yeah. Prior to this amendment, there was arguably no guidance provided to superannuation trustees to determine whether or not there was a relationship which warranted the dependent partner being eligible to receive any death benefits. In my view, the issue of at least having a list of criteria provide better than no criteria at all. I think that the list of criteria, yes, could in fact place a higher restriction on people in the same-sex relationship. But the interdependency issue is not only related to same-sex relationship, it is related in the superannuation industry, as I understand it. The atypical interdependency issue is in regard to spinster sisters.
Yes,
is the standard that's used. So I think it is better than what it has been. I think, yes, if you looked at a narrow interpretation of the dozen or so criteria that is in the CIS Act regulations, a trustee or a board collectively could, in fact, narrowly interpret it. But that's certainly not the CPSU's view.
Thank you. And you've also raised this question of the DUA's policy parameter guidelines and the non-use of the expression sexual preference. I rather gathered reading from your submission that you're not quite certain what that's directed to, and to say I wasn't either when I... what's your impression of what they're trying to prevent?
Well, given that the reference is so brief, it's hard to know. And the question that we ask is what processes, if any, are put in place, for example, to measure and monitor the agreement-making process in order to ensure that discriminatory provisions aren't included in agreements. That's one of the reasons that we've suggested that the provision be expanded, so that there's more detail in relation to how agreements comply with that particular policy parameter. Given the discriminatory provisions that we've identified in relation to the list of carers leave, bereavement leave, maternity leave, etc., we believe that needs to be tested far more soundly than it has been.
If I can sort of summarise that as well. The page 5 of the
supporting guidance workplace policy parameters, which I've provided, actually lists what the policy parameters are. You know, it lists sort of, you know, agreements to be consistent with government's workplace relations policy. These include policy parameter 2 in regard to remuneration arrangements, policy parameter 3 in regard to funding, 4 in regard to redeployment, reduction and retention, etc. Nowhere in those policy parameters does it talk about the prevention of discrimination, that agreements should satisfy a standard that does not discriminate.
Mm.
So our concern is, although this document does, I think on page 13, identify as part of the prohibited contents discrimination, that's the only reference in it. It refers back to effectively the Workplace Relations Act only, saying you can't have this in an agreement. It provides no guidance, no information to employers about what their obligations are.
As I understood part of your submission, you were saying that one of the problems with the AWAs is that it really means that the individual who believes there's discrimination have to pursue the remedies themselves. I just wondered what remedies you thought they could pursue if that they perceived they'd been discriminated against because of a same-sex relationship.
That's an interesting question, isn't it? It depends on the nature of the form of discrimination, and it also depends on the content of their workplace individual agreement, AWA, if it is indeed an AWA. We believe, and I know some people have suggested that individual employment contract negotiations will somehow provide greater opportunity for people to tailor terms and conditions more specifically to their domestic purposes, particularly if they're in a same-sex relationship. We certainly believe that if that did occur, it would certainly be the exception and not the rule, given the imbalance in power within the relationship at the time those contract negotiations occur. And as Joe pointed out in her submission, often people are put in a place of either take it or leave it. In terms of pursuing remedies, there are obvious risks associated with that for an individual who takes on an employer in at the moment, which would see a termination of employment at the end of the starting period of that relationship, executed without very many questions. So in answer to your question, the remedies are not easy for individuals.
Thank you. Ram, did you have
no,
any?
I don't. No.
Can I thank you both very much for coming along and making those submissions. You raised some very interesting points, and thank you also for these additional documents and for the best and not quite perfect practical situations which you've identified there. Thank you. We'll certainly look at those. Thank you.